The next person that I would like to introduce has been wonderful to work with. When Carl was in charge of the Imagination Fund, he bent over backward to help us. If we wanted to do something, he was going to find a way to help us do it. If we had an idea, he was going to help us find a way to make it happen. And so I've already introduced him with his title, which is that he is the director of our National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute. But the real thing is, he's an incredibly delightful, intelligent gentleman. Gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Mark Riccobono.
Thank you, Mindy. I appreciate that welcome. I appreciate you getting the cookie crumbs off the podium as well. She really did sample the cookies. That's what I heard. How's everybody doing? Excellent. Well, I really appreciate this convention. It's been a great convention, and I really feel blessed to have the opportunity to be here with all of you this evening. And it really is a humbling task to think about what I might say to all of you that might be meaningful in the context of our movement. Let me say that I come here this evening with an open heart, and I would ask that all of you approach this the same way. I think you'll find in my journey similarities to yours. And what we have in the National Federation of the Blind is an active participation model. This organization only works if we actively participate. It would be easy for us to take from the organization, but the organization really only works if we all participate and we all put our heart into what we do. Now, these days, sometimes when I go places, not so much here, but in other places, people like to refer to me as the blind driver. I appreciate you haven't pigeonholed me into that. But I am sometimes known that way, and I like to say at the beginning of some of these speeches that my story is so much more than that, but I do want to talk about that. Now, in case you were waiting, I'm not going to talk about Daytona much because people ask me often, what was it like to drive at Daytona? And I answered that question a little bit in the monitor this month because I've never had a good answer to it, so you'll have to read the monitor for that. But I do have a question for each of you to reflect on as I get started this evening. And that is, are you a driver or a passenger? Are you a driver or a passenger in your own life and within the National Federation of the Blind? And this is really a central question that I think about a lot. You know, was diagnosed as being legally blind at age 5. I grew up in Milwaukee. My parents didn't know anything about blindness. We didn't have blindness in our family. They knew nothing. We didn't know other blind people. So they encouraged me the best they could. They did what they thought was natural to get me out to do the things that I was supposed to do. But we didn't know what the experience of blindness would be. I have glaucoma, so I've lost vision all my life. And when I was a child, I could still see quite a bit. Now, when we're children, of course, no child, and being a father of three, I know this is true, that the kids think they're the drivers in the family. But you know, when you're a child, you're not, right? You're still a passenger. You're learning. You're not the one making the decisions. And of course, when you're a blind child, it's your sighted family members teachers, oftentimes teachers of blind students that like to refer to themselves as vision teachers, friends, sometimes people that don't have such great attitudes about blindness. Those are the folks that are our drivers. And we begin to get certain messages from the folks around us. What I found when I was a child is that other kids were learning to be drivers, but I was still a passenger. When I got to third grade, I started using large print books, and that was the first time I ever met an orientation and mobility instructor, came by the school, walked me around the neighborhood a little bit, and decided I was doing all right, so they left. Now, I had been walking to school. The school was about 6 blocks from my house since first grade. I don't think I walked there anymore. So I've been walking to and from school every day for 2 years. By that point, of course I knew the neighborhood. Drop me in the middle of some other neighborhood, who knows what would have happened. But that was the evaluation. In fourth grade, you know, it got a little harder to read the print. The teacher would come by now and then, and we didn't talk about Braille or things like that, but she'd help me fill out worksheets. The students are right in the back there, right? Where are the students? Students? Anybody? They went to sleep. Okay. Well, so since the students left, for the rest of you, you'll know. The student division cut out, apparently. The rest of you will know what a mimeograph is. We used to have, I know I'm not that old, but we had worksheets on mimeograph. And it was this blue ink that nobody could read, let alone a little blind kid who didn't know he was blind. So the teacher of blind students would come by, and what she helped me do was fill out the worksheets. She's kind of like a high-paid reader, actually. But we didn't talk about blindness or Braille or anything like that. I was really on my own, and I had learned from my parents to work hard and do the best I could, and I was getting by, so I was under the radar, you know, I wasn't having trouble. I got to fifth grade, I started looking around because I couldn't read the large print books anymore, so I found that I had a monocular available, and I started reading the large print books with my monocular. Now, if you don't know, a monocular is really meant for distant viewing, so you have to do certain sort of body contortions to read large print books. And still, no one looked at me and thought, I wonder if there's a better way for this kid to be educated. No one paid attention. And it went on like that. I could tell you dozens of stories. And every time I would start to get the message that I was just a passenger. And when I got to middle school, actually, besides being a passenger, I was just passing. I was faking it to make it. I don't know if you can relate to this experience, but I was faking it. I could hardly see anything. Remember, by fifth grade, I was reading large print books with a monocular. I lost all the vision in my left eye in eighth grade. Now, where do the passengers often sit? In the back, where the students used to be before they left. and so I sat in the back of the class because that was a place to be passive. Notice. Now, since the students left, I can say this, but often in the back, oh, they came back, thank you. Often in the back of the class were the folks that, well, they weren't the brightest in the group. They really weren't the brightest. And I would hang out back there with them, and I could stay under the radar, and we'd do engaging, stimulating things like play table football. See, what you do is you fold up a little piece of paper and you flick it back and forth and you can have hours of fun and mostly avoid doing schoolwork, because what I would do is get someone else to fill out the worksheet for me. I don't know if their answers were ever right, but, you know, that's what I would do. I passed. I was a passenger. I showed up at high school and it was the first time I ever knew there were other blind people, that there were other blind kids. And I had a teacher at the high school. He was a blind guy. And I actually thought he might be a mentor. Problem was, I didn't really know he was a blind guy. He had RP. And he read Braille, but he read Braille with his eyes. So I learned pretty quickly that I was different than the other blind kids. My perception was I could either see better than they could, therefore I was better off. I was smarter than they were, under the perception that I had had better opportunities, although they had faced many of the same low expectations that I had. I didn't find commonality with them, even though I was hitting all of the same walls that they were. I showed up for debate. I thought, debate's something I can do. All I got to do is talk, right? And I went to debate my freshman year. I got paired up with a football player. I guess that was because I was used to hanging out in the back of the classroom. And all I could do was first pro, because I could memorize my little 8-minute speech. That I could do. But after that, I was worthless. I couldn't take notes. I couldn't read notes. It got harder. My sophomore year, things a little more difficult. I went back to debate. Took me a little longer because I had more going on. The coach came and said, you haven't memorized the speech yet. I said, that's true. He said, well, I guess you can't be on the team because what are you going to do? I said, good point. So I left and I never went back to debate. And there's dozens of stories of having the desire to do something, but not really knowing that I had the internal capacity to do it. I could tell you about prom, but I'm going to skip that. And there's other embarrassing moments that I could tell you about.
Oh, do tell.
I'm sure there'll be some coming, don't worry. Because I was a passenger in my own life. And I didn't have some of the tremendous educators I've seen buzzing around this convention who really, in their hearts, believe in the capacity of blind people and understand how we can engage blind young people with adults to make them know that there's a future that they can design. I did graduate from high school, though, and I got a graduation gift from my teachers. This is a fold-up white cane. It's the first time I ever got one. It's kind of nice. I didn't know what to do with it, but I did take it to the University of Wisconsin. And I used it during the summer orientation because I thought it might be good not to fall down the stairs in front of the co-eds. But I quickly fell into my old pattern. Cane went in the corner, and I only went on the paths that I knew, and I only went out in the times that I was comfortable, and I studied 3 times as hard as everybody else because I didn't have the skills. And I was going to college because I understood that's what you're supposed to do. By the time I got midway through my sophomore year, I was about ready to give up. I was hitting the wall big time. I started looking around for help. I met a blind person in Madison, Wisconsin, on a listserv and on the National Student Listserv, and he said, well, I live in Madison. Why don't we meet for lunch? I said, great. I picked the place because I knew where the place was. And I went there, and I'm standing outside. And this tapping sound comes down the street. And this totally blind guy comes right up to the place, whizzes inside right past me. I'm like, hey, I'm right. I want that. How do you do that? It's the first time I ever had a blind person demonstrate to me that there was something more out there than what I had known. And I was very fortunate to get a scholarship from the National Federation of the Blind of Wisconsin. I had been applying for a number of years, and they kept looking at me saying, you don't believe in yourself, and by the way, you think you're better than most blind people. And they were right. But thank goodness they gave me a chance, because I showed up at the convention in Anaheim, and my life was changed forever. My spirits were lifted. Blind people were running circles around me. And every single person I met directly and indirectly said to me, you know, you can do better than you're doing now. And we'll show you how, if you want to. For the first time in many years, I had hope. I didn't know how I was going to get there or what it was going to be like, but I had hope. I came back from the convention and I wrote a letter to the president of the National Federation of the Blind. Not a guy I knew, but I had heard him. And I had a bunch of literature that I brought back that had his name on it, so I wrote him a letter. Darn it if the guy didn't write me back. Dr. Maurer wrote me a letter in August of 1996, and he said to me that he could teach me how to take charge of my own life, but that he needed help. He needed my help in working on the organization that taught him. It's not the exact words, but that was the essence of it. And I was astonished by this idea. First of all, that I was needed, and that there was a whole body of folks willing to help me. And that some blind guy who seemed pretty darn impressive took the time to write me back. Well, at that time, you know, I was like a 16-year-old. I mean, I had the keys, but I didn't have the skills to drive. And I had a lot of learning to do. I needed the training and experience. And luckily, the National Federation of the Blind gives us that, right? It starts with, it is respectable to be blind. That's really the underpinning of what we do for each other, and I like to relate it to what Dr. Tenbrook said at our 25th anniversary. He described it as the faith that we have in each other, the faith that can move mountains and mount movements. It is respectable to be blind. I didn't believe that. I didn't know why to believe it. But people kept telling me to believe it, and they kept showing me. They had faith in me even though they didn't know who I was or what I had to offer. The basic dignity that I was a person and they cared about me is what brought me up. Competing on terms of equality. You have to determine your own future. That's what I heard. And once you determine where you want to go, you need the training. And go get the best training you can get to do it. That's not a message I'd gotten before. I learned how to drive from Federationists who took the time to share their experience. And I also learned that the best way to learn was to start teaching. And so I got actively involved in our student division in Wisconsin. Actually, we created the student division, and after a couple years, I was president of our Wisconsin affiliate. I graduated from college, went to Sears in their National Executive Trainee Program. Thought I was doing pretty good. Got some training at the Colorado Center for the Blind. Was doing a little better after that. And I had been doing some advocacy work, and the state superintendent of public instruction had a meeting with me. I think I actually asked for the meeting. I was 24 years old, and he starts asking me these questions. He says, now, if we wanted a blind person to apply for a job, what would we do? And I start telling, well, you know, you'd have to, if it's a form, you'd have to make sure the form's accessible, or you'd have to help them fill it out, you know. And then he said, now, if we had a blind person just walk in today, you know, and apply for it, what would we do? And I give him some. He says, now, if we had a blind person, like, right now that we wanted to apply for a job, what? I was a little slow. He wanted me to apply to direct a new state agency that was going to oversee services for blind children, including the School for the Blind and Outreach Services. I didn't have any training besides the Federation in education. And I didn't have any training besides my own miserable experience in the education system, which were two pretty darn good qualifications for making a bunch of changes. And I got hired at age 24 to run this state agency where pretty much everybody in the place was against me because they didn't want the place to change. And they didn't necessarily, all of them, believe that it was respectable to be blind and that blind people could compete on terms of equality. And besides, I was one of those radicals, especially when I walked in with my long white cane and suggested that as blind people, we should be mentors. So I had to go to Federation events to get fired up, to get refueled. And, you know, it's easy for us to get comfortable where we are. And that's why we challenge each other in this organization, and we know who we are, and we know we're not going back, but we also know that we need to push each other forward. Luckily, I had great mentors in the Federation that helped me do that, even in the face of folks that really just didn't believe in blind children in the way that we do in this organization. Things came to a head when the Department of Public Instruction gave an award to a special education administrator in the northern part of the state. His name was Ed, so I like to call him Special Ed. True story. It's a true story. He put out a memo to his teachers. Where are the teachers in the room? Yeah, see, they're still here. He put out a memo, and I know you're going to relate to this. He put out a memo to his teachers. Now, this is now 10 years ago. He put out a memo to his teachers that basically said, thou shall not provide more than X number of hours of Braille to any student in a week. This is against the law. This is against the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And the Department of Education, who I worked for, gave the guy an award. So you got to decide at some point, right? Are you going to be a driver or a passenger? So I talked to a few folks about it, including some state legislators. Some of them happened to be good friends with the guy, so it got a little rocky for me. But I wasn't about to let somebody decide arbitrarily how much Braille some blind kid was or wasn't going to get. Because I didn't get Braille. I was told they could teach me Braille if I wanted to learn it. Why would I want to? No one ever told me. So I could have stuck around in Wisconsin, but I went to talk to Dr. Maurer. And I should have just read the letter, would have saved a trip, but that I got in 96. He says, well, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go? There's that lesson again. What do you want to do with your own life? How do you want to drive in your own life? Where do you want to go? What do you want to be? I told him I might want to work for the National Federation of the Blind. And then he made me come back a second time for an interview. Luckily, I did pretty well. And in 1 month from today will be my 10th anniversary as an employee of the National Federation of the Blind. So I showed up a couple months before we opened the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute, another 10th anniversary we're coming upon. And at the grand opening of the Jernigan Institute, we had this great display of a car that a blind person could drive. It's like an innovative mock-up. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a cool, nifty idea, way to capture people's imaginations. I mean, not very practical, but, you know, that it's a great hook. It's a great hook. See, I didn't believe in this idea. Well, in 2007, Betsy Zaborowski had been the executive director of the Jernigan Institute, and I showed up to work one day, was called into a meeting, and Dr. Maurer said, now, we're going to have some changes, and Mark's going to be our new executive director. I thought, you know, the guy didn't ask me if I wanted to do the job. But you got to be pushed once in a while. And I had resolved in my own life that I was going to be a driver, and I have a love for this organization and what we do. I was scared to death. I didn't know what I was doing. But we have a faith in each other that pushes us to new places. And I don't know how many in this room knew Betsy Zaborowski, but she was a tremendous leader of ours. The very last time that her and I were together in the Jernigan Institute, she sat across the desk from me, and she came in and she said, "Do you have it all figured out?" I said, "Oh yeah, absolutely. Got it all figured. No problem." She looked at me without skipping a beat and said, "It's all right. I didn't have it figured out either. You'll figure it out." The faith we have in each other matters. When we go out in the rest of society, almost universally, people don't believe in us. But we believe in us, even when we're unsure. I'm certain she was kind of wondering what I was going to do with the thing, but she didn't express it. And that's what drives us. So when I got a call the next year from Virginia Tech and they said, "Hey, we like this blind driver idea. Can we come work on this?" I thought, now I got to go sell the idea. I don't even really believe in it. So I went to sell the idea. They said, "You know, we could stick a blind person in the back of one of these cars we built to drive themselves and push a button and we're done." I said, "Whoa, wait a minute. Actually, what our president has said is we want to drive cars ourselves. We want to drive. Wait a minute. We want to use our ability to think and react." And they said, "Oh, that's a little harder." But we started working on it. We built a prototype and we took it to our youth slam in 2009. And we had these high school students driving this red dune buggy around this parking lot. And see, they hadn't been told for decades like I had that we could do anything except for drive. They didn't know they couldn't drive. No one had ever told them. And here was some technology allowing them to zip around a parking lot. And they said, "Man, we got to work on this. We got to get this done. How do we do this? This could, you know, what could we do? We could do all sorts of cool stuff with this." We change each other by raising each other up. Those kids changed my perspective. And so we went out and we started working on building a car that a blind person could drive. And Virginia Tech said, "Okay, it's going to take us 18 months to do it." And we went back and we said, "Okay, in 12 months, we're going to have the first public demonstration at Daytona. So be ready." And they said, "Now, you heard it's going to take 18 months." I said, "Yeah, but the first public demonstration is at Daytona in 12 months." And a whole bunch of us in this room were doubters. "Oh, man, this is so big. How do we believe in this?" But we believe in each other, and we started building it. I want to tell you some of that story, but in the process, being in Baltimore, my wife is also blind. She's president of our Maryland affiliate, and we had our first son, Austin, who was born in 2006. And in the midst of getting ready to announce that we were going to drive a car at Daytona, which we hadn't even built or owned, my daughter Oriana was born on May 15th of 2010, and we were there in the hospital. And I went over to, you know, they were poking and prodding her like they do in the first couple of days, and I went over to pick her up, and the doctor says, "Now, I want you to go see a pediatric ophthalmologist on Monday because your daughter's eyes don't respond as we expect." And my heart skipped a beat. And it skipped a beat not because of blindness. I know what to do about that. But all of the painful experiences of being a passenger in my own life, of waiting for hope, of facing an education system that didn't believe in who I was, came back to me. And that's where it was more real than it's ever been, how important it is, how urgent it is that we change the education system in front of us. It's probably one of the biggest problems we've ever faced. But we have to do it. Not just for my daughter, but for all the other blind kids out there. And I don't know about you, but that's enough fuel to keep me going for a long time. So we said we're going to drive a car, and we had to learn how to drive. That was the first thing. Which is the gas pedal and which is the brake and all that. So we bought a car and we started getting blind people to drive the car around. And then we started testing the technology and we rented a racetrack in Virginia. And the theory was that the engineer said, well, we need someone that's driven before because they'll understand driving better and they'll do better. And Dr. Maurer said, no, wait a minute, hold on. His theory was that if they've driven before, they're probably going to be scared to death of what they don't see out the windshield. So we tested the theory. Turned out that, Dr. Maurer's theory is that age matters a little more, but I think that's just because he got booted from the process a little early, you know. But it turned out that actually driving experience didn't matter that much. We challenged each other. We did stuff with the technology, and when we'd see someone, one of our blind brothers and sisters, do something with the technology, we'd say, hey, I want to do that. I got to figure out how to do that. And Dr. Maurer was in the process, and we were going to be at Daytona, and we all kind of thought, well, Dr. Maurer, this was his idea. It's his vision. He should be the one to do the demonstration at Daytona. He was very clear that no. The best driver is the one who drives. And at first I thought, you know, we could throw this thing and he could win. But that wouldn't be keeping faith with what he wanted. The love we have for each other also means that we're willing to challenge each other and that we're willing to tolerate being challenged. And we get to better places because we challenge each other. So after we knocked Dr. Maurer out of the competition to drive at Daytona, it was down to Anil Lewis and I. And our center training, our training from our centers is very helpful to us in all aspects of life, right? So just take this as an example. The engineers had this theory that we had to drive a very wide lane, and at first we had to drive very slow. Now, what happens when you walk slow? Come on. You run into more things? No, that's not it. What happens when you walk slow? Oh, it takes you forever. That's true. Okay. You don't walk as straight. If you walk faster, you walk straighter. Same is true for driving. That's the whole premise of why we tell people to have a longer cane so they can walk faster and therefore straighter. Same is true for driving. So we used our center training in what we did. We got to a day where we had been testing and testing and retesting, and we finally said, you know, you guys, you have to get out of the car. We've always had an engineer in the car. They usually didn't say anything, but they were always there. We kicked the engineers out of the car. We had tested this technology. We've been doing all sorts of nifty stuff with it. We refined it. And I got in the car. I turned on the radio. The police was on, which I thought was kind of ironic. And I'm driving this car all by myself. No one around. And I had kind of thought, well, this will be interesting. But it was more powerful than I had ever thought. So we showed up at Daytona, and the day before, we were supposed to do a public demonstration. We were there in the parking lot, and how ridiculous is this? I'm getting driven around by a blind person, And I'm driving blind people around, and the president of the National Federation of the Blind shows up, and I'm his chauffeur for the day. How ridiculous is this? Is this surreal or what? And then my family shows up, and I get them. You know, loading in the car seats is actually harder than driving a car, I got to tell you. And I get them loaded in the car, and it's the first family road trip. And here is the thing. The skeptics would say, who cares? All you did was go around a parking lot. You didn't change anything. You didn't get anybody in. But of course, these are the same folks that would not dismiss Kitty Hawk. They would not dismiss the effort to go to the moon. This was significant because we've embarked on something that no one else would have even attempted. And I can tell you that I viewed the possibilities for my family differently when I could drive them around a parking lot. Because a year ago, 2 years before that, 3 years before that, although I was doing pretty good, I still put limits on what I could do and what we could do and where we could go. And so the challenge we have now is to continue to actively participate in this organization no matter how well we think we're doing, because we need this organization. I'm participating in a Baltimore leadership group. 53 other high-powered type A personalities in the Baltimore community besides myself. I'm the only blind guy in the group. Makes me stick out a little bit. But I've been working with these folks for 6 months now. You know, at first it was a little tough. You know, we'd be walking somewhere and they'd say, isn't it ironic that the blind guy's leading? And after a couple of times, I'd start pulling them aside and say, tell me why it's ironic. Just because I've been paying attention to where we're going and you haven't, I mean, tell me. You know, I spend enough time with them that I can challenge them a little bit, right? We don't get that chance with most people. So after 6 months, this last couple of weeks, we went to an Outward Bound. You know, we're supposed to jump off of stuff and climb stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, I've been with these guys 6 months. They'll get it. They know I'm with them. I'm an equal. But they were freaked out. God. There's a rock climbing wall. And I'm thinking, you know, I've done rock climbing in Colorado. This is like a piece of wood. This is nothing. Oh, how are you going to do this? If it wasn't for my friends in the Federation who keep me grounded in the understanding that their perception of reality, my leadership friends, their perception of reality is not the reality we actually live in, and it's not the reality we have to live in, because we get to be drivers in our own lives, and if we are drivers in this organization, we can go to places that we had never imagined, and that we believe in each other in a way that no one else is going to, because they just can't understand our common experience. And I have to say, I really appreciate the driving that I've seen going on here this weekend. A lot of tremendous and powerful work that's going on. People stepping up to take leadership in this affiliate. People making commitments to do things. Stretching our thinking. I've heard a number of people putting new ideas out, inspiring ideas about how we can go beyond where we are, whether it's being a producer of tactile graphics rather than just a consumer, or being the owners of the Bell program. That's a big step for us, right? A little scary, but we can do that, and we want to do that. And here we have some teachers in our midst who are facing some pretty difficult circumstances from their administrators. But yet they're willing to stand up to them. And they're willing to come here to get the inspiration to do it. That's inspiring, and that's driving. So what I want to encourage all of you to do tonight is to really look in your heart and say, are you a driver or a passenger in your own life and within the National Federation of the Blind? I have given us a drive at Daytona, but we need more drivers. I can't be the only one that's willing to face the skeptics and move us forward. And the skeptics won't be the ones who stop us, nor the historical images of blindness, as long as we commit ourselves with love and faith to be drivers in our own lives and for the National Federation of the Blind. Thank you very much.
Our cause goes marching on.